This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and on this Thanksgiving, we are eating and giving thanks. And farmers deserve a great deal of that thanks. We hear from small farmers about the labor of love that is cultivating food. Today we hear from Amber and Ross Lockhart of Heart and Soil Farm, Jacqueline Weber of Folkstead Farms, and Sam Rydell of Nurtured Plains Farms. They spoke at November's First Fridays at B in Moorhead, a monthly discussion about food.
My story starts in a garden, the garden of my youth. Very vivid memories of stealing watermelons and hiding behind my garage and then eating them in their entirety.
I did not grow up on a farm. I did not study agriculture in college.
I have no agriculture background. I never intended to live on a farm or be a farmer.
Technically, I'm a fourth generation farmer.
I came into it completely ignorant. I knew nothing. It allowed me to come into it with a completely open mind to be open to learning about what is the best way to grow food.
I probably learned how to can vegetables and bake bread before I knew how to pedal a bike.
I didn't always set out to become a farmer. It seemed like not a very smart career path. It seemed like it was a dead end, and it had a lot of hardships and things that were completely outside of your control, like the weather or the commodity markets.
When Ross and I met, I said, if you want a farm wife, I'm probably not the girl for you. But little did I know.
Thor's my partner in farm crime. He had me at, I'm a CSA farmer. I had him at, I'm an English teacher with my summers off. Yeah, farm labor and newsletters all in one.
After high school, I went off to pursue culinary arts. And even though that wasn't quite the right path for me, it really kicked off this lifelong romance with food.
I didn't start farming to farm, and I started farming to get out of a previous career.
Ross and I, after college, we moved to the West Coast for warmer winters. We encountered people talking about food in a different way than we remember growing up here. They talked a lot about local food and where does your food come from and how is it grown and do you know your farmer and how are the farm workers being treated and what's the environmental impact of how the growing's done.
Leaving the farm was really when I sort of had this realization that the role of the farmer is to grow food. And that may sound funny because, you know, I grew up on a farm and that's sort of what we do, right? But I think there's such a disconnect between the way agriculture is done today, between what you grow and how it's used and where it ends up.
I have an endless list of gratitude for our time running a CSA, but at the top of that list is becoming a part of a community of members who would brave the seasons with us. What an honor to be a part of their food journey and food stories. We cultivated far more than food. What we cultivated was friendships with like-minded people who really care about the health of the planet, their bodies, and healthy food systems.
I learned the importance of local food, growing food for the community that you're growing it in a way that's doing the least amount of destruction to the soil. So important. Often more important to focus on that than the actual crops themselves.
You know, I don't want to trash on production egg producers, but growing up on a big farm, if you will, could be way off on this, but it seemed like the measures of success were how many acres you could accumulate, how many combines you had, or how many bushels you could produce. They didn't really resonate with me very much. Starting Heart and Soil Farm, we've set out to kind of set up different measures of success. What we focus on our farm is flavor and taste. We try to find things that grow well here, but also people like to eat.
It's about our daughter. We wanted her to learn where her food comes from and how to grow her own food and how to be a little bit more self-sufficient. It's about the environmental impact and how we use our soil. If we're not going to leave the land better than we got it, we at least try to do no harm. And so it's sort of our own quiet activism.
What really interested me was kind of this nexus between where food, farmers, and human health come together. The whole soil health aspect is a cornerstone of our farm, obviously. The name of our farm is Heart and Soil Farm. To us, that really goes hand in hand with the nutritional aspect of what we grow.
Every soil is different. You're constantly trying new things, whether that's cover crops, finding out what different varieties work well, rotating and adapting. A focal point of small farms is how adaptable we are. The little amount of mechanization and equipment we're using. You know, if my fields have a large outbreak of some tomato fungus, I can just move it and rotate it to a different area, or I can stop growing tomatoes and plant something else simply by buying different seed. It's not as easy when you're on a large scale.
When you have healthy soil, your plants practically grow themselves. And when we dig into the soil, we want to see a lot of worms and a lot of activity going on in the soil. And that's when we know we're doing a good job.
It was some of the hardest work I've ever done in my life.
We're at the point in the year, we're just exhausted. And we're kind of having those reflective questions right now about, you know, should we keep doing this?
Sometimes we get really bogged down in the labor of what we do. That is what tires our souls, our beings. Reading Wendell Berry, who is sort of the philosopher, poet, farmer, really brings that back to you and reminds you why you're doing it when your body tells you, please stop.
So why do we grow? Why do we keep growing? In this world of warring countries, enemy neighbors, planetary neglect, we grow because it keeps us connected. Keeps us mindful of our planet's health. It gives us a reverence for the soil health, for the nutrient-dense foods that can be grown when our soil is well cared for. And also, there are so many meditative benefits to just digging our hands into that soil, especially when the sun's setting. We have so much sky.
I have such a sense of pride to be back here and to be able to grow food for neighbors, for people that provided me with so much when I was growing up. It drives me every day to do that in a way that is sustainable and that in a way that ensures that we have the fertile soil that we do for the long-term future.
It's incredibly fulfilling to grow something and shepherd it through the whole process of its life and harvest it and hand it to somebody that's going to take it home and they're going to feed their families with that and the people they love and they're going to talk about it. Food is sort of what connects us all together. It's the focal point of our celebrations.
We continue growing because we're really passionate about the dance, the seeding, the growing, the harvesting, the preservation, the preparing. Thor and I fell in love in the garden. We did. We threw open our garden gates and our kitchen doors, and we welcomed in our family, our friends, and our communities. We set a place at our table for anyone who wanted to join, and that's something that we cannot stop. It's a part of our moral fiber, the fabric of our being, and it feeds us and it gives us purpose.
One of the greatest revolutionary acts that you can do is grow your own food. It's incredible the amount that you can produce yourself on a small piece of land. We're desperately in need of new farmers, that we're losing farmers at an alarming rate.
Be ethical, be political, be moral, stand up, speak for food, put local food on your table, put local food in your bodies. Promote it. Help farmers stay farmers.
That was Amber and Ross Lockhart of Heart and Soil Farm, Jacqueline Weber of Folkstead Farms, and Sam Rydell of Nurtured Plains Farms, speaking at November's First Fridays at B. This is a community discussion about food. Coming up next, the indigenous roots and traditions of a harvest feast.
I hope that the listeners on Prairie Public tune into the Thomas Jefferson Hour, because I believe that we need to lift the idea of civilization and civility and culture. that we need, in a sense, to rise to the occasion of being what Jefferson had in mind for this civilization, and that the only way to do that is to be self-conscious about it and to work together to create the conditions under which we know we would be happier, more fulfilled, and more enlightened. And I think that the Jefferson Hour, in the broad world of public radio, is an important niche in which that project finds voice and creates a community of people who want to live in a more enlightened world than the one we happen to be born into.
Join Clay Jenkinson for the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Sundays at 11 a.m. Central, 10 a.m. Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and we continue our food theme with a look at the indigenous side of a Thanksgiving table as we dive into the food native to this land, the post-colonial rise of fry bread, and other native traditions. Sarah McConnell hosts the show with good reason, and today she speaks with American Indian scholars Anton Troyer and Corrine Wood about their food traditions, and with Chef Sean Sherman, or the Sioux Chef, that's S-I-O-U-X, about the indigenous roots of Thanksgiving.
All the different berries, all the different tree foods, all the different plants and roots, all the wild ginger. There's deer, there's elk, bison, there's duck.
I'm Sarah McConnell, and today on With Good Reason, we're exploring Native American traditions and Thanksgiving. Anton Troyer is a member of the Ojibwe tribe in Minnesota and the author of Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask. How could we resist bringing him on the show to answer all of our questions? Anton, do American Indians celebrate Thanksgiving as a rule?
It depends on how you define Thanksgiving. Certainly all Native people from throughout North and South America have customs and traditions around expressing thanks. But there's great diversity in exactly how Native people express thanks. Just in the United States alone, there are 566 different federally recognized tribes, and each with its own distinct language, customs, traditions, and so forth. As far as the American holiday of Thanksgiving, I think you'll find a variety of experiences there too. I know for myself and my family, I get a couple days off of work like most Americans do. We do spend the time with our family, and we do take a moment to express thanks, but we also use that as an educational moment to dispel some of the myths out there that seem to permeate our educational system even today.
Have you found over the years that you and your children and your wife have come to put a particularly Ojibwe slant on your celebration of Thanksgiving?
Well, when we do our customs and ceremonies, we do them entirely in the Ojibwe language, so it will definitely sound and look quite different from the customary American feast with the bird in the center of the table. In Ojibwe, we'll say miigwech for thank you. It literally means it is so much, like overflowing generosity. And when we do our ceremonies, we will give thanks for everything that we receive. We'll say, help show us what to do, and then give us the strength to do what we are supposed to do.
Do you speak Ojibwe yourself?
I just said, yes, I do speak Ojibwe, as do many people at Leech Lake, where I'm from. And my native name is Wagush, which means fox, and I'm from the Eagle Clan.
Your mother was a tribal judge, and I understand the first female Indian attorney in the state of Minnesota.
That's right.
Did she also have a command of Ojibwe?
Yeah, I would say that our family, going back, her mother, Luella, who's actually still alive and in her 90s, my mother, and to myself, it's been kind of a decolonizing, reclaiming process. Mm-hmm. So my grandmother is a survivor from residential boarding schools, and this is a policy that the United States government began in the late 1800s to indoctrinate Native children into American culture. And Native people were customarily removed from their home communities and families, and were not only instructed in the English language, but usually received pretty harsh physical punishments for speaking any language other than English, even if that was the only language that they happened to know. And so she had to work very hard to reclaim those things. And for myself, it was perhaps a little bit easier in some ways that I grew up being dragged around to ceremonies and frequently encountering fluent speakers. Although, like many kids, it really wasn't till I was an adult that I appreciated any of those things.
What about your own children? Have you taught them phrases or even the whole language?
Oh, yes. One of the hats that I get to wear is I'm very involved with officiating and helping at our ceremonies in the region, and the children are always with me and in tow, and those are done exclusively in our language. We try to use it as much as possible at home, although at school, with my work, when we travel, there's kind of no way to avoid English, and so they all speak that very well, but they also know their own ways in terms of language and culture, so they can hunt. We make maple syrup and sugar every spring. We snare rabbits and harvest wild rice, and kind of have, for me, kind of one foot in the wigwam and one in an ivory tower, but it's one complete existence, and it's what gives a lot of meaning to life.
Oh, that is wonderful. I bet they have loved learning some of these native ways.
Oh, yes. I think most Americans who've come here, whether they're a fifth-generation immigrant or brand new, sometimes struggle with the pressure or just the reality of disconnecting from motherland and mother tongue. And although people heal and function and integrate into mainstream America, a lot of people do feel that something is fundamentally missing. And in spite of 500 really hard years for Native people, one of the great ironies is that we still do have vibrant cultural and linguistic traditions, and in some ways more tools to rebuild and maintain that sense of identity so crucial to healthy human living.
Where do you think we should go from here as a country? Because I think many people nowadays sort of yearn for a kind of idyllic Native American past and are disposed toward sort of embracing the Native American culture, though they may not know what it is and have misunderstandings about it.
Yeah, Indians are often imagined and infrequently well understood. And as a result, some people somewhat romanticize Native existence. Other people kind of don't know enough to know what they don't know, but kind of pity Native people, have this perception that they're all living in squalor on reservations or something like that. And so all these competing, you know, misunderstandings don't really advance knowledge, but I think it's really important to remember that America has some ugly chapters in its history. And although most Americans wish that these things were reconciled, it's important to remember that we can't skip the reconciling. So as far as looking forward, I think it's really, really important to take a deeper look into history, to really examine the origin of inequities that still exist in our country, and then we can do something about it.
A couple years ago, you wrote a book, Everything You Wanted to Know About American Indians But Were Afraid to Ask. Looking just at the portion of that that deals with pilgrims, Indians, Thanksgiving, this time of year, what are some of those questions that you answer and that people have?
A lot of people sense that there has to be more to this history than we are hearing. It is true that when Europeans first arrived in the northeastern part of the United States, that Native people encountered them immediately. And native knowledge was part of how Europeans first survived the New England winters. But when you look at the Puritans first arriving in 1621, there's no evidence of a joint native, non-native harvest celebration really until 1637 is the first evidence of anything like that. And the initial exchanges that they had were soon overwhelmed by a period of extreme violence. British settlers who came here, they came to take land and displace native people, and eventually things blew up. By the time it was over, about 5% of the European American population in the Northeast had been killed, and about 40% of the indigenous population was killed, not by disease, but in conflict.
So when we look at the elementary schools where most of the Thanksgiving lore is perpetuated, would you say you wish that we would not be donning pilgrim and Indian costumes and teaching first graders how to feast together?
To me, I think Thanksgiving should be an entry point to look at the way that Native people helped shape our shared history, the way that Europeans changed the Native experience, not just conflict, but there was a whole exchange of ideas, of foodstuffs, and so forth. And I think doing that can be really healing, not just for Native, but for non-Native people too.
So around the time of Thanksgiving, if you're not celebrating Thanksgiving per se in your family, are you getting together to have a feast and activities?
We are. Actually, it's really harvest time for us, so we will be doing a lot of hunting and fishing especially, but we've already completed our wild rice harvest. This is a kind of water-based grass where we push a canoe through the rice beds and knock the seeds into the canoe and parch them, and it's one of our staple foods. And now we're kind of doing a lot of deer hunting, grouse, and rabbit and so forth. So we'll be very active and we'll be in the woods quite a bit. But as we do that, we will feast those things. So for us, it's taboo to just eat rice as soon as we harvest it or eat an animal as soon as it's killed. There's kind of a process for thanking the animal itself and then giving thanks for the bounty that we have. For me, one of the really beautiful things about our rites of passage involves this practice. So for us, when somebody kills their first deer, for example, we usually would cook up the entire deer, or if people are kind of scattered, we might cook up part of it and then package and give away the rest of it at the feast. But the young successful hunter, who's usually kind of a teeny bopper when they're first successful, is sat down and we will put all the food on the floor rather than on a table, put out a blanket or a mat and place the food there. And then we will speak to our common creator, Great Spirit, who we also believe created and placed amongst us many other spirits as kind of intermediaries. So there's a head spirit in the water, there's one in each of the four winds, and so forth. And then we'll ask these spirits to bless this new hunter and to give thanks for his harvest. And then instead of eating, usually the mother will take a spoon of the food and offer it to the young hunter on a spoon, and the young hunter has to refuse the first bite. So the mother will say his name, Bejagobines, and he has to refuse the first bite, and he has to say something. He has to say, "No, I'm thinking about young people in this world who don't have enough to eat." "Ah, okay." She'll put the food back, she'll take a new spoon, offer it to him, and say, "Bejagobines." He refuses again and says, "No, I'm thinking about my elders who can't get out into the woods to hunt for themselves." "Oh, okay," put it back, take a new spoon, Bejagobines, and offer it again. And again he refuses and says, "No, I'm thinking about my family and my community and the people who came here today to support me." And then they offer him a fourth bite, Bejagobines, and he can eat. And then they'll say, "Now look, Bejagobines, you've just changed your life. Up until today, you were dependent upon everybody in this room to provide 100% of your food. But today, you're feeding all of them." And with this incredible power comes the great responsibility of thinking about young people who don't have enough, thinking about elders who can't go out and get it for themselves, thinking of your family and your community. And then he gives away his first kill, and he's given teachings by the hunters about the customs and culture of harvesting. But it's this instilling of a sense of responsibility to others that's at the heart of Thanksgiving.
That is such a beautifully told story. Anton Troyer, thank you for talking with me on With Good Reason.
Thank you very much for having me. Miigwech.
Anton Troyer is executive director of the American Indian Resource Center at Bemidji State University in Minnesota. He's been a Guggenheim Fellow and MacArthur Foundation Fellow, and is the author of Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask. These days, there's one food you can count on seeing at Native American feasts, and that's fry bread. Every family seems to have a unique recipe or particular technique. Karen Wood of the Monacan Indians of Virginia joined producer Lilia Fukin in the kitchen to whip up their own batch of fry bread.
With her dark hair pulled back in a ponytail, the poet and anthropologist began to get our studio's kitchen ready for our fry bread extravaganza.
We're going to make fry bread, which is a not-so-traditional Indian food.
We measure out the flour, salt, water,
and about a teaspoon of baking soda. I use my hand to measure it out. So we just keep stirring it up until it's nice and gooey. And then you just start adding flour until it becomes workable. Not too much, though.
Karen stretches and pats the dough into soft, round saucers.
There's a joke about Native women. How do you know when you're at a powwow? You see all the Native women are clapping sideways like this, like they pat the fry bread out. Hard to explain on the radio.
The oil's nice and hot, so it's time to put the dough into the skillet.
And you flip them when they start to turn golden?
Yes. Okay, so that's done.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they're beautiful and it smells good.
They are.
The fry bread smells so good, colleagues begin to drift into the kitchen.
Wow, when will technology be able to record smells?
Is it something that people make at home a lot, or is it just a powwow food?
I would say in reservation communities, people make it at home all the time because there's still a lot of poverty. It's also something you would expect to be at every celebration. You wouldn't have a Native gathering on a reservation without fry bread.
You can top fry bread with just about anything, from sweet jams to taco fixings. And Karen lays out the plan for the gravy we're going to make.
We're going to melt some butter and mix some flour with it to make a little roux. And then we're going to get this jar of canned venison.
That's right. She said canned venison. This is another first for me.
Yeah, this is venison from a deer that was shot last year. You see there's a piece of bacon on the top to kind of keep some moisture in the meat because venison doesn't have any natural fat.
Now, Karen's a Monacan Indian, and sometimes she trades with a friend from the neighboring Chickahominy tribe. And this time, it was a home-baked cake for a large mason jar of tender meat. Karen gives the history of Monacan-Chickahominy relations in a nutshell.
So we used to be enemies back in the old days. We used to come down to the Chickahominy territory and raid their corn. We don't do that anymore. So we get along pretty well, but we still have to trade. That's how it works. Yeah.
So now I'm going to take a bite and see how it turned out. Wow. Oh, it's amazing. The fry bread is great, but the gravy's really what makes it.
The magical gravy.
Oh, my goodness. The history of fry bread isn't a long one, but it's a painful one.
During the late 1800s, a lot of tribes were confined to reservations, and they were issued rations.
Sickness and starvation were devastating on the new reservations, but this is where the flour and lard rations were first turned into fry bread.
It's a very simple food made from a very desperate time, and it's become a native tradition where people share it at powwows and at native gatherings.
For With Good Reason, I'm Lilia Fukin.
Fry bread, please give me some fry bread. I can taste it now. I need to get me some fry bread. I need an Indian taco tonight, and I'll give it back. If it ain't cooked right, don't hook it up.
The Minnesota St. Paul area offers just about every kind of cuisine you can imagine, except the cuisine that was there first, Native American cuisine. That will soon change with the opening of the Sioux Chef, S-I-O-U-X, a restaurant serving traditional pre-contact food of the Dakota and Ojibwe tribes. My next guest is the Sioux chef himself, Sean Sherman. Sean, with Thanksgiving upon us, how would you cook a pre-contact Native American Thanksgiving meal if you were doing such a thing?
Well, luckily, that really ties in well with what I do, because even though people don't realize there's so much indigenous food on that menu with turkey and sweet potato and pumpkin, wild rice, there's so much to do, you know, duck and goose. So, you know, it'd be really easy to pull together a showcase of indigenous foods for Thanksgiving.
What are some of the ingredients or dishes that are featured in Native fare?
Well, there's so many foods in the region that I'm focusing on right now to utilize, and it really kicks off in the springtime with maple season when people start to tap the trees and get the maple syrup. And also birch syrup's another great one that people used to do and don't do as much anymore. And then shortly after maple and sapping season, all the fiddlehead ferns come out, all the ramps, which are wild leeks, come out. I've been really lucky to be in Minneapolis because there are a couple of native-run farms that are starting to grow a lot of the heirloom variety seeds of the corns, beans, and squash. And just having people around the state and area who can help collect and forage and preserve some of these great things with all the different berries, all the different tree foods, all the different plants and roots, all the wild ginger. Proteins in the animals were the easy part because, you know, I'm going pre-European, so no beef, there's no pork. There's no chicken, but of course there's so much. You know, there's bison, there's duck, there's deer, there's elk, there's moose, you know, there's rabbit, there's all the fish, the white fish, the trout. There's quite a bit to utilize.
I love the name of your new restaurant. You've got a play on words for this eatery called the Sioux Chef, with Sioux spelled S-I-O-U-X.
Right. It worked out pretty well. I'd been using that as my email handle for quite a few years.
And you do come from a tribe called the Lakota Sioux?
I am Oglala Lakota, so we are part of the Sioux group of people that stretches all the way out from, you know, Minnesota into the Dakotas. So I grew up on Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. So my background and, you know, my tribal affiliation is with the Oglala Lakota.
I've read that a number of the items on the menu that could be ordered will be things that I'd probably never heard of. There's something called Wojapi soup. Is that how you pronounce it?
Wojapi, it was a very simple berry sauce when I was growing up. It was traditionally made with choke cherries, which grow wild all across this region from where I am in Minnesota all the way out through the Dakotas. So we picked them quite a bit growing up, and we cook it all the way down into almost a jam form. But I had read a lot of traditional usages. They would just kind of make a soup out of it, too. So I played around with both forms of it.
Let's look at some more of the menu for your forthcoming restaurant. I understand one of the dishes might be stewed rabbit with fiddlehead fern. Is that right?
Yep, I've done that before. I did a dinner in the spring where I was utilizing spring flavors like the fiddlehead ferns as they come out early. They're all over the place in Minnesota.
Are they yummy?
Oh, they're very good. It's like a tender asparagus.
Oh, wonderful. You could probably find them in many parts of the country.
Oh, yes. Yep. The ostrich fern grows all over the place. So easy one to find. One of the first things you see popping up in the spring.
What else will be on your menu?
Well, I really want to pull back some stuff from my childhood. My parents and my grandfather taught us how to find timsalas out on the prairie, which are a prairie turnip. I really enjoy growing up Lakota. We used a lot of buffalo and just the smell of that slow cooking all day on the stove. Every time I make it, that smell just brings me back to that time and place.
Do you have any simple snacks or appetizers planned?
You know, I really enjoy making real simple stuff like wasna or pemmican, which is basically the dried meat with dried berry and maybe a little bit of fat. And it was kind of like a power food that people could, you know, wander around with and keep in their pouches and nibble on here and there because it just really packed a punch nutritionally.
That sounds wonderful. And what about libations?
I will have beer and wine, but I don't really want to focus on it. I really want to focus on indigenous tea flavors. So I've been working really hard with other people around the state to try to find sources for a lot of these amazing flavors that grow all throughout Minnesota, Wisconsin.
What have you found so far that pleases you?
I really enjoy making a lot of cedar tea lately and sweeten it with a little bit of maple. I think balsam fir also makes an awesome tea. So utilizing some of these lost flavors is kind of fun for me. And they're so healthy because they have so much vitamin content within them also.
Are there also desserts that are available?
Well, I think cooking these berries down into sauces, I think using flavors like sumac and rosehip also to make jams and jellies with, sweet cornbread with just maple sugar, poaching fruits as they come through. And there's a bunch of wild plums up here too. So there's a lot of fun fruit and, you know, syrup flavors to play with.
Will you also be making fry bread in your restaurant?
You know, I'm choosing not to make fry bread only because I really feel fry bread doesn't represent the vast knowledge of what people were eating traditionally and indigenously. And there's plenty of other places out there that focus on fry bread. And it's been a staple and it's been something that I grew up with. I just really wanted to focus and show people how much more food and flavor is out there traditionally for all of us.
I've heard recently about people trying to make meals out of acorns and such, but I imagine that was not really a Minnesota staple.
You know, acorn flour is a big part of Native American foods where they grow. And, you know, being so tannic as they are, that's a little bit of processing, but it's totally worth it. And it's also free food if you can get them. And, you know, the best way is to get them right off the tree before they have time to, you know, kind of rot on the ground. But you can really get some great flour by grinding it up and, you know, leaching it in a little bit of water to get all that tannin out of it. It really makes a great staple.
Do you mind, as we're preparing meals for our own family gatherings, giving us a simple recipe with maybe ingredients we can find that might represent some Native American Indian fare?
You know, some really simple stuff that I've done is just a smoked turkey and hominy soup. And I really just took whole pieces of smoked turkey with the meat and bone on and just let it slowly stew for hours upon hours with some, you know, fresh hominy. And just season it really lightly with just some herbs that I could find around. So I've used maybe a little bit of cedar. I've used sage, the touch of salt to make it work out, and then maybe thickening it just a little bit with a little bit of cornmeal. And it makes such a real simple soup with so few flavors. I really like this minimalistic approach to cooking that really showcases the true bright flavors, a lot of these great flavors around us.
That sounds great. When do you open?
I am hoping to open before March this year.
Well, I wish you all the luck. Sean Sherman, thank you so much for sharing your insights on With Good Reason.
Well, thank you so much.
Our thanks to the show With Good Reason from Virginia Humanities. Coming up next, Main Street Eats with Root Cellar Sue.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Listen to our podcast or a previous broadcast anytime, anywhere. In your home or on your phone, you can catch Main Street on any street. All day, all night, a friend in Fiji or your aunt in Vermont can tune into a show you just know they'd want to hear, or they can browse older shows for other topics of interest. Our app and archives are easy to find. They're right on Main Street in the radio neighborhood at prairiepublic.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and in our Bismarck studio, Sue Balcom of the Rootsellers Farm near Mandan.
It is time for another installment of Main Street Eats with Rootseller Sue. Sue, thanks for joining us.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here.
And it's a great time of year to talk about winter squash. So set us up with a definition first of the difference between a summer squash and a winter squash.
Hey, first of all, I prefer winter squash because they just have way more flavor than summer squash. And if I mention what a summer squash is, you're all going to go, oh, yeah, because a zucchini.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, zucchini is a summer squash. They're soft-skinned, they're prolific, and they're quite watery. And while you can bake with them, you can't make nearly the wonderful food that you can out of a winter squash, which are usually deeper in color, they're deeper yellows, they're beautiful oranges, and they have a thick skin on them because they're frost tolerant. A summer squash will die when it gets cold, and a winter squash loves frost because then it becomes sweeter, and it also helps to solidify the package that it's in so that you can store them for nearly the whole winter.
So do you have a bandsaw in your kitchen? How do you get into the winter squash?
I feel so bad because one time I gave a squash to Marcy Nerum, and she sent me a picture on her phone about a day later of this enormous butcher knife busted in half. And I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean for you to break your knife on that squash. But yes, you need a bandsaw to get into them.
Or a microwave.
Oh, but you can't put them in there without poking holes
right.
in them or they'll blow up, right? Don't put squash in your microwave and blow them up. You need to do this the proper way, okay? I won't be responsible for that. I just read this in Cook's Illustrated, too, the other day about how hard it is to bust into a squash. And so if you don't have, like, a mega samurai sword meat cleaver type thing, you need to do it either poke or drill holes into the flesh all the way through to the center and put it in your oven or microwave it until it gets soft. And then you can cut it in half and work on it. Or they suggested, like Blue Hubbard, putting that in a great big bag and dropping it off your steps onto the concrete and then picking the pieces up.
Oh. Now, I love that idea.
I know, right? I can see what the neighbors would think if you're standing out there with a bag full of squash and dropping it.
Oh,
and
they would think, oh, there's Ashley again.
She's yeah. cooking. Who's coming for dinner tonight, right? And, you know, you might actually have to drop it twice. Some of those squash are really, really tough. You know, like your larger Blue Hubbards, which are beautiful squash, have really tough skins. But, yeah, I'm thinking I've been looking for a big, huge knife that I could use for squash, and I just don't think they make one strong enough.
Well, once you break into the winter squash, what do you do with it?
Well, it's quite easy then to take those chunks and use that use a scraper like a large spoon or a jack-o'-lantern scraper that you can save from Halloween and scrape those seeds out and scrape as much of the soft, fleshy part as you can because that's usually mostly the membrane that surrounds the seeds. And then you take and lay them in a high-sided cookie sheet or baking pan and put them in your oven at 350 until you can easily poke them with your knife or a fork. And the reason you want a high-sided pan is because they do have moisture, some more than others. And since you don't know that when you put it in the oven, you don't want that juice running out and then running all over your oven. And then you simply take them out and let them cool, and that skin will slip right off of them. It's an easy-peasy thing to do.
Squash is very good in soup.
Oh, squash is good in soup, and believe it or not, you're going to find it in almost every can of pumpkin that you buy. It's not really pumpkin. It's usually a bunch of different kinds of squash. That's really good for you. You know, like you can take and scrape that out and use it in lieu of pumpkin, which is what we do at our house. You can stick blend it to puree it or use it in chunks. if you like whatever recipe you're using, if you like it a little chunkier, I just mash it up with the fork. I don't worry about it too much. You know, pumpkin bread or, oh, I have a pumpkin roll recipe that's really, really awesome. But squash are actually really, 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 really good for you. And it's one of the world's healthiest foods website's top 10 sources of vitamin A, which, of course, you know, in the wintertime, we're not outside in the sunshine as much and the fresh air. So you should be eating more of these carotenoid-rich vegetables.
You know, speaking of healthy and maybe, I guess, a weird little drawback to squash is I've had more than one friend who couldn't have squash while pregnant because of gestational diabetes. Do you know what's going on there?
Boy, I have no idea because some squashes are really sweet, some aren't so sweet, but I'll bet it has something to do with how that's metabolized. You know that carbs turn into sugar.
Yeah.
But I've never heard of anybody that has not been able to eat a little bit of squash.
Well, and they were able to go back to squash, you know, postpartum. So it was just a weird little.
Yeah, that's kind of.
Thanks, kid.
Yeah, right. Hey, I haven't eaten beef jerky for many years because of my kids.
Sue, a while back we were talking about pumpkins because it was around Halloween and what to do with all those seeds. And can you do that with squash seeds?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I only grow pumpkins for decorations. I grow squash for the serious stuff, like the pumpkin seed, the pseudo pumpkin seeds, which are actually squash seeds.
Uh-huh.
And then using, of course, squash when I make pumpkin pie or when I make squash soup or something. Because I've never found a pumpkin ever that I've grown that has had the rich flavor that most of the squash do. And I like, there's a particular squash. Speaking of sugar and squash, there's a special squash that I grow called Uncle David's Dessert Squash. That stuff is from the Fullerton, from Fullerton, North Dakota. A family called the Podalls has raised that squash to be just an amazing sweet squash. You don't have to add anything to it. You can cook it and butter it and eat it, and everybody loves it. Even my little kids eat squash at my house.
Well, if you don't have that particular squash, what do you like to put on it?
Here we go again. I like savory squash. So when I bake a squash in the oven, like a buttercup, a butternut, I like putting just butter and salt and pepper on it. But then I always have to make a batch for my husband that has brown sugar on it and then cream if you want, cream afterwards or, you know.
I really like a lot of squash with cheese, like a blue cheese
really?
Or a feta.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I got to try that sometime.
Yeah, do yourself a favor. I mean, I like a lot of blue cheese with
anything.
Yeah.
I'm a fan of blue cheese, too. And you know what? It's really hard to get a good blue cheese dressing in a restaurant, isn't
oh,
it?
Oh, yeah. Don't bother. Please don't.
They don't even know what that is. Gorgonzola by any other name.
Well, we'll have to leave it with that. We check in with our Sue Balcom every week. Thanks for being with us, Sue.
Thank you, guys.
Hi, I'm Cassie Shipley, Donor Relations Coordinator for Prairie Public. If you're a sustaining member, we can't thank you enough. Your generous monthly contribution provides a reliable source of funding so we can bring you high-quality programming and fact-based, independent journalism. Plus, you help bring down the costs of mailing out pledge reminders. And of course, it's greener for the environment. So we know you enjoy the little extra benefit of saving Prairie Public money. But here's where we could use your help again. Expired and renewed credit cards can stop a sustaining membership in its tracks. But that can't happen when you set up your monthly deduction via a checking account. So make the switch. All we need is your bank's routing number and your account number. That's it. So make your monthly gift to Prairie Public count even more by switching your sustaining membership to a checking account monthly deduction. It's easy to do. Just call me, Cassie Shipley, at 800-359-6900, extension 538, or email at sustainer@prairiepublic.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 22nd. On this date in 1906, the Hope Pioneer newspaper reported on a meeting of the local Women's Christian Temperance Union. The purpose of the organization was to educate about the dangers of alcohol and drugs and to promote prohibition. During its heyday, the organization played an important part in North Dakota's history, expanding its concerns to include women's suffrage, labor laws, and prison reform. Susan B. Anthony organized the WCTU in 1874 because men would not allow women to participate in Christian temperance meetings. The guys even adding men to the name of their group to make it clear that women were not welcome. Jamestown hosted the state's first Women's Christian Temperance Union Convention in 1890. The meeting drew a huge crowd, largely because the keynote speaker was Susan B. Anthony. The organization quickly caught on across the state. Prohibition has a solid history in North Dakota. In 1887, the territorial legislature gave communities the right to enforce prohibition on a local level. When the vote on the state constitution was held, an amendment approving prohibition passed on a narrow vote. The saloons closed on July 1, 1890. North Dakota became a dry state, but illegal alcohol remained readily available. As part of its effort, the WCTU urged members to erect public drinking fountains. The hope was that men would take advantage of the free water instead of going to the secretive illegal saloons for stronger drink. One of the remaining WCTU fountains can be found in Park River, North Dakota. The North Dakota chapters also supported the goal of national prohibition. This was accomplished when the 18th Amendment was passed in 1919. As prohibition became a nationwide reality, the membership of the WCTU began to decline. After prohibition was repealed in 1933, North Dakota also began to relax liquor laws by allowing beer sales. Hard liquor followed in 1936. The noble experiment was officially a failure. The WCTU is still active today, opposing the use of alcohol, tobacco, and illegal drugs. It operates a publishing house and offers programs to schools, but membership is just a sliver of its peak in 1931. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
That's it for this Thanksgiving edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, the Oral History Project StoryCorps promotes a retail-free alternative to Black Friday, and they call it Day of Listening. This year, StoryCorps paid a month-long visit to North Dakota, and we share a selection of stories recorded when the mobile booth called the North Dakota Heritage Center its home. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your Thanksgiving.